today on Against the Grain, what happens when socialist theory and practice intersect with struggles for national liberation? What role did Marxist theory play in anti-colonial movements? I'm CS. The historian and journalist Vijay Prashad talks about what he calls the entangled tradition of Marxism and national liberation, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Many people, many socialists, have thrown themselves into the struggle to end capitalism. Others have risked their lives in the struggle for national liberation, for independence from colonial rule. These two sorts of struggles have often intersected or even fused. Intellectuals and revolutionaries in Latin America, Asia, and Africa have brought Marxist theory into anti-colonial projects and movements. What's been the result? Have Marxist principles been treated as dogma, or have efforts been made to adapt them to the particular conditions of countries like Vietnam, Peru, and Egypt? And what about national liberation movements that targeted hierarchies other than class? Are they properly considered Marxist? Vijay Prashad, known for his penetrating investigations into the radical ideas and movements that have circulated and often flourished in the Global South, recently produced a dossier about Marxism and national liberation in association with his colleagues at Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. Vijay Prashad is an historian and journalist, the director of Tricontinental, and the author of many books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. His most recent book is Washington Bullets, A History of the CIA, Coups and Assassinations. When Vijay and I connected recently, I asked him about what motivated the writing of the dossier, titled Dawn, Marxism and National Liberation.
Capitalism is a universal system and it has a universal logic, but it manifests itself differently in different parts of the world. And that has to do largely, but not exclusively, to the impact of European colonialism. European colonialism did, if I may be quite crude about it, did two things. One is it essentially plundered these parts of the world of an enormous amount of social wealth, not just resources, you know, as people commonly understand it, not just resources, but social wealth. You know, in India, for instance, the weavers had been producing a manufacturing industry in the region of the Bengali-speaking people, today's Bangladesh, today's West Bengal in India and so on. The weavers of this part of the world had produced quite an advanced manufacturing sector, producing various kinds of textiles and so on. Their wealth was essentially ripped off by the British by first destroying the manufacturing sector by force, then compelling India to be an exporter of raw cotton crop and being an importer of machine-made fabric from England. At the same time, forcing Indian agriculturalists to grow indigo to color the cloth and to grow opium to force onto the Chinese people and so on. So, you know, there's an element of plunder of social wealth that defines the development of these parts of the world. And it's quite significant, the levels of the plunder. The other thing that colonialism did to these parts of the world is, in an odd way, it either froze or it distorted the development of societies. Now, you know, for millennia, people have struggled for all kinds of things. One of the enduring things is for forms of freedom. You know, the fight, for instance, of the people in Haiti that allowed them to make their revolution in 1804, the first major revolution in the southern part of the globe. When they fought to make that revolution, it was not so different from struggles taking place in Asia. It was not so different from, say, the Boxer Rebellion later in China, or the uprising in 1857 in India and so on. These are stirrings for a kind of freedom. Freedom may be defined in different ways, but stirrings of a kind of freedom. What colonialism did was it distorted social development, because here you had this major external power, military power, making alliances with old, rather wretched social forms and fixing them in place, you know, fixing old aristocracies, allowing the leaders or the people who benefited from things like caste or tribal rule to stay in power longer than, in a sense, their lease on power, because the normal course of human development would have dethroned them. You know, that's what happens in most places. But this alliance of the external force and these internal, rather wretched forms of social life, they kind of froze social development in many places. And caste is a really good example. It's an old, rather ancient social dynamic in India. There were developments in the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th century to overthrow the caste system right into the 18th century. And then the British come and they kind of freeze caste through the way in which they offered power to localities, the way in which they favored certain castes and so on. They took advantage of the caste system to dominate people. So it's important in our institute, we want to look at, you know, the theories that develop out of the parts of the world that used to be colonized, theories of freedom. And therefore, if you're looking at theories of freedom, you have to have a science of the world as it is. Well, the most advanced science we have, in a sense, and I know this is odd saying this out aloud, the most advanced critical science of the world we have today, of capitalism, is of course Marxism. And therefore, it's important to take seriously the kinds of Marxism that developed in places as distant as Peru, as Kerala, as China, as Indonesia, and so on. And I think too frequently, as a consequence of the enduring cultural hegemony of Europe and North America, even in the continent of Marxism, even in the Marxist continent, you have the dominance of thinkers from Europe and the United States around the world. And we wanted to say, no, wait, let's not catch our colds from Paris, London, and New York. Let's listen to what's happening in Lima. Let's listen to what's happening in São Paulo, in Johannesburg, and so on. And that was the impetus, as it were, for this dossier.
Do you sense that there's a dominant understanding that theory, that radical theory, is or has been produced in Europe, in the West, and that the so-called third world has not advanced that theory, not created that theory, and has merely used it for its own purposes?
Yes, exactly. So there is a rather unfair characterization of revolutionary thinkers in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And I'm going to give you some examples of that. There's a very unfair way in which they are characterized. For instance, it's often said of them that they are not real Marxists. What they are is they are either derivative of Marxism produced elsewhere, let's say Marxism produced in the Soviet Union, or Marxism produced in the North Atlantic states, and so on. Or they are merely writers of manuals of struggle. So focus can be on Che Guevara's, you know, revolutionary war text, or guerrilla war text, guerrilla warfare text, Mao's text on guerrilla warfare, again, armed struggle, and so on, Giap's text on armed struggle. This is where they say there may be some originality in this tactical way. Now, I have just finished a book, which is Selected Writings of Ho Chi Minh, Selected Writings and Speeches of Ho Chi Minh, actually, and a lot of it is freshly translated from Vietnamese, things not available previously in French or in English or other languages. Now, Ho Chi Minh has been anthologized several times. What runs through all these anthologies of Ho Chi Minh's writing is everybody says he was not a creative theorist, or he was not a theorist, or he was not a Marxist in the sense that he wrote theory, and so on. Now, I found this very offensive, to be frank with you, because none of the people who've anthologized Ho Chi Minh's writing, and few of the people who've written biographies of him, have attempted to actually understand what is Ho Chi Minh doing in his texts. What is national liberation Marxism? In the introduction to the selected Ho Chi Minh, I go at great length into elaborating the many texts of Ho Chi Minh to try to put together something like an elaboration of this kind of theory that Ho Chi Minh operated with. You can't make a revolution without a theory. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela produced a theoretical understanding of both the revolutionary process, why elections were important, why it was important to have referendums on a regular basis, what were the missions, what are the comunas. There's a theory there. So looking at Ho Chi Minh, I said, well, there's a theory here. What's the theory? The first thing was that he learned a great deal from Lenin. From Lenin, he took this idea that it's perfectly possible to advance a socialist revolution in an extremely poor country. You know, firstly, this idea that the worker in Marxism must be an industrial worker is misleading. It's misconstrued. The worker in the Marxist theoretical discourse, in the whole, you know, framework of Marxist theory, is the productive worker, the worker who produces surplus value. You can produce surplus value in the fields, you know, field workers, agricultural laborers, landless peasants and so on, they produce value for those who own the land. You're still producing surplus value. You are in part of the working class. So Lenin's idea of the worker-peasant alliance greatly influenced Ho Chi Minh. That was the first principle. You could organize the peasantry into a socialist organization. You didn't have to wait for the bourgeois stage to develop capitalism. You had to advance to socialism. Why did you have to advance to socialism? Ho Chi Minh well understood. In a country like Vietnam, under French colonial rule, briefly Japanese, and then the attempted US colonial rule, they were not going to, you know, build industry in Vietnam at the time. They were not going to advance the productive forces. They were going to rack rent the peasantry. They were going to brutalize the people, treat them as animals, you know, as, you know, people who could be beaten, dismissed. Their own productive capacity didn't have to be developed, which is why when the British left India after 300 years, literacy rate was about 14%. You know, that's scandalous. They didn't develop the productive forces, which includes making the population literate and making the population democratize production and so on. That was off the table. So Ho Chi Minh says, look, if I'm going to wait around for something that's not going to happen, which is the productive forces develop, we can never have socialism in the colonies. So therefore, the idea that national liberation is part of the socialist project was key to thinkers like Ho Chi Minh, to Mao, you know, to Jose Carlos Mariátegui in Peru, to Fidel Castro and others. They understood very well that there is no stage theory, that the first stage is develop the productive forces, have a bourgeois revolution, then advance to socialism, have a socialist revolution. No. And they knew that you didn't need this because, after all, the Bolsheviks had shown you can escalate to the socialist revolution. Now comes the problem for this kind of Marxism. How are you going to build the productive capacity of the people? You don't have advanced capitalist institutions. You don't have advanced capitalist banks. You don't have capital, for God's sake. How are you going to do it? So they theorize. And here Ho Chi Minh starts to think about a collective mastery. Lam Chu Thap Thế. You know, how do we make a collective mastery? How do we organize the productive forces in a way that everybody feels that they're participating? Aggressive land reforms. They tried it from 53 to 56. 56, they did a review and said, oh my God, we've made lots of mistakes. Let's go back to the drawing board. Let's rethink what we've done to landlords and so on. Constant rethinking, constant adjusting. And then he comes up with another theory, patriotic emulation. People need to emulate each other. This is very much like the innovation in Cuba, when Che Guevara said one of the key aspects for us has to be volunteerism. People must come in large numbers, and public action in the productive domain has to be part of our social development. We saw this actually in the Soviet Union in the early years, you know, this idea of mutual public action for mutual gain. The building of an agrarian revolution was very important to their theory because you had to smash hierarchies in the countryside. If you didn't smash the hierarchies, you couldn't create collective institutions of welfare. that provide health, education. You have to have a theory for all this. So this kind of attention to the actual philosophical thought of a revolution is really what Marxism is about. Marxism gets abstracted in parts of the Western academy into philosophy, into ontology even, you know. It's very far away from the actual experience of building and maintaining a revolutionary process, constructing socialism and so on. So I was keen, and our team was keen, in drawing out the lineage of national liberation Marxism to show a generation how these earlier thinkers grappled with the blocks of social reality, the granite block, as Fanon called it, you know, on which you have to carve your destiny. You've got to carve your destiny on that granite block. You have to understand it. Then you have to find the tools and you have to learn to carve. And all of this has to happen in an extremely creative way.
Vijay Prashad is my guest. He is director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, the author of 30 books, including Washington Bullets, A History of the CIA, Coups and Assassinations, Red Star Over the Third World, and The Darker Nations. We are talking about a dossier recently issued by Tricontinental entitled Dawn, Marxism and National Liberation. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you point out that Marxist movements in the so-called Third World had to act in relation to, and in some cases merge with, the struggle for national liberation. So you have the struggle for national liberation from the colonizer, you have the struggle for socialism, and the aims of those two struggles can be very different, right? The socialist struggle is often a struggle for social emancipation, worker emancipation. You have national liberation, this idea of self-determination, independence from the colonial oppressor. So, and you also have national liberation struggles that may not be socialist in orientation, may not be communist in orientation, may not be radical. They may be reformist. They may simply want to eject the colonizer. So in this dossier, you address a number of thinkers and theorists and revolutionaries in the global South who struggled to align their Marxism and the Marxism of their political parties with the national liberation struggle. Give us a couple of examples of that. I'm just curious what kind of success or shortcomings you saw in those efforts.
So the first thing I want to say is that, yes, there are national liberation movements which are led by, say, forces that are not committed to socialism or not committed to communism. So in practical terms, that means they were not always committed to land reform or genuine democratization of the economy. They were not committed to damaging social hierarchies like caste, like various sort of gender hierarchies, different ethnic hierarchies, and so on. What happens in these nationalist projects that don't move to socialism is that they produce inside a society, or they reproduce, great rifts, social rifts, hierarchies, the wretchedness, the hideousness, and so on. They keep society weak. And so you might have political independence, but you're extremely weak socially. And it's that social weakness that allows external forces to come in, that allows imperialism to exert itself. And because there is not a cohesive social system developed, you know, a new kind of social system developed on an egalitarian platform, often the nationalist leadership, the elite, turns for help to the old colonial masters. And we see this again and again, you know, where countries which had become independent essentially become subordinate allies at a different level. So in fact, this was something quite clearly, it was clarified by Ho Chi Minh in his writings. He said, look, we declare independence in 1945. And now because of the war with the French, when the Vietnamese were able to defeat the French in Dien Bien Phu in 1954, they had the Geneva Accords. And until the 17th parallel, that is, North Vietnam, was governed by the communists, they immediately went to land reform. Why did they do that? And Ho Chi Minh explained, the reason we have to do that is we have to create a society in the North. There is no society. You know, we have been dominated, our social lives have been curtailed and so on. So we have to struggle against history to build a society for which we have to democratize rural areas and so on. When Ho Chi Minh was writing and saying these things in India, one of the most eminent theorists of the Indian Revolution, a man from Kerala, who was the first elected chief minister of Kerala as a communist in 1957. His name was E.M.S. Nambudripad. E.M.S. Nambudripad developed a similar argument. He also argued that, look, root and branch, the left has to attack social hierarchies. The left must go after the kind of indignities of caste, the really terrible indignities of gender hierarchies or patriarchy and so on. You can't ignore all this. We got to, because we have to create an egalitarian society, you know, and only an egalitarian society will strengthen us to be able to withstand the pressure from external forces and so on. Now, they didn't succeed in India in building a revolution, but in his own Kerala, a state now of 35 million people, the Left Democratic Front remains in power. It's led by a communist chief minister, Pinarayi Vijayan. So EMS's theory has had an immense impact on Kerala, which is a highly literate society where many of these hierarchies have really been shaken. Now, look, CS, I'm not going to exaggerate things. It's not easy to overturn these hierarchies, but they've been shaken.
Well, some people hearing you talk about EMS and his focus on, for example, caste and other hierarchies that don't have to do with kind of classical class in Marxist terms might wonder, well, to what extent is this Marxism? I mean, is this a legitimate adaptation of Marx? Is this a whole new avenue?
You see, our Marxism is the understanding that capitalism cannot solve the problems that it creates. I think that's the first principle of the Marxism that unites people of different tendencies of Marxism. I think basically if that's an axiom. If you accept that axiom, the door opens for you. The issue is, of course, that capitalism manifests itself differently in different places. We have to acknowledge that. You know, you're not going to get capitalism looking the same everywhere. Because capitalism has the ability to draw surplus by taking advantage of older social hierarchies. It can draw surplus by taking advantage of things like patriarchy, for instance, you know, or it can draw surplus by taking advantage of racism. The very clear-headed idea that in some parts of the world, the standard of living can be kept lower. You know, why should people in India make higher wages? They can do with less. You know, it's this attitude, CS, that you'll get that the respect for life is less in places like that. When 5,000 people die in a tragedy, well, it's 5,000. In the United States, if two people die, it's a big outcry. It's not true. In India as well, a parent loses a child, they grieve. They grieve because they are human. It's a racist idea that says, oh, no, they have a different understanding of life and so on. That's nonsense. But the fact is that idea that people are, in a sense, not to be accounted for, their individuality doesn't matter, that racist idea means you can squeeze more profit out of them. The idea that women, will do the housework and the social reproduction means you can squeeze more profit out of the family and so on. So these older forms of hierarchy are mobilized by capitalism to increase accumulation. Now, but we have to pay attention to what are these old hierarchies. If you're going to tackle the capitalist system, you got to know the soil on which it grows. You can't pretend that everywhere is England. You see, Marx, at least in Capital, wrote all three capitals, 1, 2, and 3, wrote mostly with the European example in mind, except once in a way, things came in from other parts of the world. But if you look at the Grundrisser, if you look at his notebooks, the theories on surplus value, even marginal notations and so on, the letters that he writes to Vera Zasulich in Russia, Marx writes with great understanding of the different social development in different places. In fact, to Vera Zasulich, one of the most well-known Marxists in Russia, he writes in a series of letters, in fact, one draft, the final draft of four draft letters. He's trying his best to get this letter properly. So he writes three previous drafts and then the final he sends to her. He talks about the fact that Russia's social development is different than the rest of Europe and that Russia can advance to socialism differently than, say, in Britain and so on. That means he's paying attention. What's the mir? You know, what's the communal form of life in Russia and so on? So people like EMS, they have to analyze, you know, the social reality as it comes before them. They can't pretend that Kerala is like, say, some, you know, version of the United Kingdom. It's not. It got its own thing. So their Marxism is to understand how capitalism lives on the soil of the Kerala, you know, of the Malabar coast, of Trivandrum and so on. They look at the exact way in which capitalism develops, and they see the role caste plays, the role gender plays, the role ethnicity plays, religion plays and so on. And then they develop politics. See, they understand that class is one of the principal optics to understand how surplus value is extracted. But class doesn't appear in the world always in one form, in a clear, pure form. It comes filled with saturations of social hierarchy. And that's what you have to peel out. Well, EMS was in the thick of the struggle. He was theorizing as he was fighting. And for that, you keep trying to refine your thought. And I find that to be the most elegant way to understand the method of Marxism. Marxism, again, is not a formula. Marxism is a method to create the most viable theory to advance the struggles to socialism.
Vijay Prashad is an Indian historian and journalist. He's an author. He's the chief correspondent for Globetrotter and a columnist for Frontline India. He's chief editor of the New Delhi-based Leftward Books. We are talking about a dossier issued by the organization that the institution that he directs. It's called Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. It's an international movement-driven institution focused on stimulating intellectual debate that serves people's aspirations. The name of the dossier is Dawn, Marxism and National Liberation. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You devote a good chunk of the dossier, Vijay, to the ideas of José Carlos Mariátegui. He was a Peruvian Marxist who lived from 1894 to 1930. So he was a Marxist. He was a self-avowed Marxist. And yet he looked around at the situation on the ground in Peru for what social forces, what social dynamics existed that could foment, that could help foment a socialist revolution, a movement, a transformation in the direction of emancipation. What did he find that evinces the kind of creative Marxism that you applaud and that you describe in this dossier?
It's important to say that we are speaking just when in Peru there is a new president, President Pedro Castillo. Pedro Castillo comes from a party called Peru Libre, which is a Marxist-Leninist party. So for the first time in a very long time, in fact, I think the first time in Peru's history, you have an authentic Marxist-Leninist party dominant in the Congress, in the legislature, and you have a president who was a school teacher and a trade union leader as the head of the government. It's pretty extraordinary that this is Mariátegui's Peru, which now has Marxists in a position of some influence and authority. José Carlos Mariátegui leaves his native Peru, goes to Europe, really is astounded, like so many people. You know, Ho Chi Minh, his contemporary in France, astounded by what the Bolsheviks have done, in particular the writings of Lenin, quite transfixed by what he's reading. When he returns home, he thinks very seriously about the possibilities of advancing the social struggles in Peru in a socialist direction, a communist direction. Now, what he of course finds is in Peru, the matter is not so simple because, you know, Peru is largely a colonized society, not in the way that we generally understand direct colonialism in India, but it's a colonized society. There are aspects of the old Spanish colonial state in evidence. Peru's economy was basically subordinated to Europe, Great Britain having an enormous role, particularly in the guano industry, which is, you know, bird droppings for fertilizer and so on. And so Mariátegui looked around and he thought, well, yes, there's a small industrial sector. These are largely descendants of Spanish migrants, descendants hundreds of years ago, some of them. But as you go slightly to the edge of Lima and then outside Lima towards Ayacucho and so on, you'll find that the dominant population is Amerindian, native peoples of the Andes. And so Mariátegui says, well, you know, what does one do here? I mean, how does one make a revolution where there is this terrible landlordism in rural Peru? At the same time, there are these old ideas of community, these older ideas that the Indian peoples or the Andean natives hold on to, where they just don't want to be considered as individuals in a kind of modern sense, but they actually cultivate their old ideas of community, the Ailu idea and so on. And so Mariátegui writes a great deal in the journal that he edits, and then in a book that comes out in 1928, which is published as Seven Interpretive Essays on Peruvian Reality, where he tries to say at the center of things, we must have the native Andean, you know, the Indian must be at the center of things. Now, he's writing at the same time as there's a developing idea of indigenismo, or let's call it Indianness, where people would fantasize about, you know, the Indians and say, oh, Amerindians have this great culture and Amerindian ethnicity must be celebrated and so on. And Mariátegui says, hold on a minute. The point isn't just to celebrate the culture, because then you're just looking at people in a zoological way, you know, like as if they are to be their holders of their culture, but they are not able to be participants in the making of history. So he says, no, wait, look, we have to understand how do we advance history? And for him, in a way, the past, as we wrote in the dossier, the past is a resource. It's not a destination. You don't want to go back to the past. You want to go ahead. You want to advance things into the future. And that was a very interesting element. But he also said, look, let's pick up on this idea of community. Let's not junk it. You don't have to go from community to individualism and then again to create a kind of socialist community. Why don't we skip the individualism? Look at how these old ideas of community have been held fast and you know, held close to the hearts of the Andean people and then advance through them. And, you know, it's interesting that we're talking now because I've been writing a lot about Peru, about Pedro Castillo, with my friend Jose Carlos. We wrote a series of articles about the movement of Peru Libre and what Castillo's movement coming from the northern part of Peru, a very humble area, what this has meant. And what it seems in some senses is that Pedro Castillo didn't come to the people and offer a kind of deracinated modernity, you know, a modernity without roots. He really spoke to where people are from. And in a sense, if you listen to his speeches, there is a lot in him of what Mariátegui was talking about. Can we go back in order to go forward? And to go back to what? Not the wretched hierarchical aspects of traditions, but these ideas of belonging, community, horizontal, you know, well-being, and so on. And let's advance those into the future. Let's not smash them in the service of a kind of neoliberal project. I find that very interesting. So there's a lot to learn reading somebody from 1928, you know. There's a lot to learn.
Was part of Mariátegui's agenda or project to locate communism in the pre-modern ancient Inca world and to say that communism pre-existed, whatever we may think of communism as arising, let's say, in a European context?
One of the elements of Marxism is to demonstrate that the world we live in now is not permanent. You know, that greed, for instance, is not eternal. Greed is not the prevailing emotion of human existence, that the relationship between people is not necessarily always formulated around greed, and that the world as it is not eternal. It was not always like this. It will not be like this forever, you know? And that's a very important part of Marxism. That's what is known as historical materialism. The demonstration that in different epochs of human history, in different parts of the world, there were different kinds of ways of organizing human production, of creating a surplus, and then there were different ideas developed, you know, and that must be understood. We can periodize human history. That means that this system we have now is not eternal. You can go to the future. So one side of Mariátegui's writings, it's true, there's a tendency there, you can see him suggest that, look, communism is the old thing of the Incas, and we can bring it back. You know, that's one way to read some of the things he's saying. But the other is, I think, more powerful than that. What he's saying is that the people of the Andes, particularly the Amerindians, have not forgotten those old traditions. And not only have they not forgotten it, it's not just in their memory, it's in their social practice. The way in which in highland communities in the Andes, communities rely on people, families rely on each other. You know, that dynamic written about by Simmel and other German theorists, the move from Gemeinschaft to Gesellschaft, you know, from Gemeinschaft being the community, the bonded community, where you have all kinds of horizontal traps in a way, you know, you're held back by kinship and by ethnicity and so on, and you develop to a Gesellschaft, which is civil society, where you're an individual in a city, you know, you can just walk out of your door and nobody knows who you are, and you talk to anybody, and you don't have any kin, or you know, you're free. But of course, you're also free of social bonds, and if something catastrophic happens to you, well, who's going to be there for you? You rely on the state, as far as Simmel and that kind of, you know, sociological thinking developed. It said you rely on the state. You know, it's the terror of dying alone in your apartment. You know, who's going to find you? Gesellschaft is liberating, but it's also deeply alienating. So what Mariátegui is suggesting is, wait a minute, there are elements of this community that exist, that are this old Incan communist community that continues to exist. Can we modernize it? Can we advance it? It's a very similar kind of thinking as what Lenin was writing about. And previous to that, Vera Zasulich asks Marx, how do we deal with the Russian Mir, the old commune that the peasants used to have in Russia? They still have this kind of communal structure. And Marx says, don't destroy it. Don't turn your back on it. Use that as the basis of agrarian democracy. You know, make that the Soviet in a sense. And that's what the Soviets did to some extent. Now, lots of errors and misjudgments. I'm not, you know, denying all that, but that was the theory. In China as well, you know, this idea of collectivization. Look, it's a wrong idea that Mao and the Chinese Communist Party imposed collectivization on peasants. There were always elements of collectivization. Collective work, collective practice was what prevented you from catastrophe. You know, when there was a harvest problem, flood, when your silos were damaged, people came together, helped each other to work. This was the institutionalization of some of those things. And they don't always work, but it's what it was. And that's what Mariátegui is talking about. Can we modernize and institutionalize the ayalu? You know, is that possible? The commune. And that's really what he's talking about. It's not only, let's look back and say, we used to have it, and that's great. Can we have it again?
In this dossier put up by Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, directed by my guest, Vijay Prashad, you point out that Marxists in the colonial world didn't always read Marx. They actually didn't necessarily read Marx's writings. They may have read about Marx, but many of them didn't read Marx. Why is that, and why is that important to understand?
Well, there's a practical thing that many of them were from workers' families and so on. Carlos Baliño, for instance, the very important Cuban Marxist, you know, whether it's Fahd from Iraq, you know, these people, they just didn't have the education, you know, the literacy to come to Marx early in their careers. They came to Marxist politics first, many of them. And then they were able to encounter Marxism as a theory in their political movements, in schools, in pamphlets, and so on. These were not people who came to Marxism in the university and then joined a party. They came to Marxism in their struggles, and then they joined a party where they learned Marxism. That was their school. And many of them, by the way, deepened their Marxism when they went to jail. Prison was the real school for lots of these people. That's when they read quite systematically and learned more, and also in some cases wrote things. Very few of the Marxist leaders in India, in South Africa and so on, had a university education. You know, Muzaffar Ahmad comes to Calcutta from rural Bengal. He comes, he's a journalist and so on. But, you know, where is the access to Marxist texts? Where's the access to high level, you know, study groups and so on? It simply was not there. And so that's important. You know, Ho Chi Minh used to joke, CS, he used to say later in his life when he was in France, he had Marxist Capital, but he used to use it as a pillow. It was his joke that he used to use, and he used to crack himself up. You know, he would tell that joke and start laughing. Well, partly it was not entirely true, because after he got to Moscow, at least, well, maybe true when he was in France. When he got to Moscow, he enrolled at the Communist University of the Toilers of the East in Moscow, a university set up by the Communist International, and he studied there. He very seriously studied there and ended up teaching there as well. So it's partly that they simply didn't come from a university background. They were not even given Marxism in hand, you know, the books and so on, didn't have access to it. Secondly, they didn't have access to it is important because they were in a colonial setting where Marxist books were banned. Let's also keep that in mind. They were banned. So it's a funny thing. You'll have a communist party in Great Britain operating pretty legally, but communism was banned in India. So in the metropole, the left was legal. The Communist Party of France was legal in France, but communism was banned in Vietnam. So, you know, you can't get to these books because they're not there. And thirdly, these parties that they joined constantly were under repression and kept getting broken up. So the parties couldn't actually create party schools. The most effective party school tradition that was built in this part of the world, in the third world, was in China. And that was after the Communist Party of China had the Long March and went to Yan'an and set up, you know, the whole world that they set up there, including universities, hospitals, and so on. But only there could they actually run schools. The Vietnamese Communist Party ran a school from 1925 to 1927. That was in southern China, and the teachers included Ho Chi Minh when he was there. He taught, in fact, an incredible class on the revolutionary path. And we are, for the first time, in this selected Ho Chi Minh, extracting from that. It's never been translated out of Vietnamese. His notes from his class in 25, 26, 27. Next year, Leftward Books in Delhi will be publishing all of his notes. It's called The Revolutionary Path by Ho Chi Minh. There were no classes in most countries because the parties themselves were banned. So, you know, it was hard to actually sit, read, think, develop ideas, and so on. They had to do it on the fly.
You write that debt and debt crises were a key focus of the vision developed by national liberation Marxists, that is, Marxist thinkers and revolutionaries in colonized countries that were working simultaneously for socialist revolution and for self-determination. In what ways did debt figure into how they thought and how they theorized?
So, you know, when we think about the way colonial forces plundered the places they colonized, think about how much wealth they took, you know, trillions of dollars, if we are able to account for everything, including the great loss of human life, the barbarity of the Atlantic slave trade and so on, trillions of dollars come into just a handful of countries. And, you know, we know because some calculations have been done. It's not a total calculation. Some calculations have been done. People have suggested that 30-40% of the down payment of British industry came from simply India. Only India provided 30-40% of the down payment for British industry. So India, which produces a lot of social wealth, saw that wealth drained to the United Kingdom to produce British industry in the 19th century. And then there was an immense differential in the economy. Places like India would go routinely into debt. This is a pattern that we see in different forms till the present time, that these countries simply don't have access to capital. And there's a way in which capital markets continue to put these countries into debt. For instance, it's cheaper to borrow money if you're a rich country than if you're a poor country. If you're a poor country, the borrowing rate is much higher because it's so-called a premium you pay against risk. That means the tendency for a poorer country to default on debt or to fail to service the debt is very high, and so debt keeps ballooning. The debt question is fundamental to this form of national liberation Marxism. It's a real central theme. You see, it's not debt so much that's an important part of the framework of national liberation Marxism. It's access to capital for social development. Where do you get capital from? You have to borrow money from somewhere, you have to construct money from somewhere, and so on. This is an enormous problem for countries. You know, you make a revolution, but you don't have any resources in your country except, you know, the land, the labor, and so on. But there is no accumulated resources. The resources of history are not available to you. Where will you get them from? You have to borrow. That puts you in debt. So it's capital for development or social development, that's the key issue. That is why so many countries today rely on resource socialism. They use the sale of their commodities to raise capital to improve the well-being of their people. That's the road that Venezuela took, Bolivia took, and so on. It's hard to come up with another road. There right now is perhaps $40 trillion sitting in illicit tax havens, just sitting there. You know, this is money that's been hoarded by a few wealthy people. If only we could get access to that.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Vijay Prashad joins me. He's executive director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. His books include The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, and The Poorer Nations, A Possible History of the Global South. And I want to ask you, Vijay, about your book, Washington Bullets, recently published by Monthly Review Press. What is that book about?
Well, so in 2019, October, there was a coup d'etat against the democratically elected government of Evo Morales and the MAS in Bolivia. Now, I'm very clear that it was democratically elected because Evo Morales was completing the mandate of an election that took place some years beforehand. There was an election that took place in October, which had been disputed. He was removed from his constitutionally mandated term that was not to expire before January of 2020. So having removed him in October, November 2019, it was a coup. His term had not ended. Whether the legitimacy of the October election was in doubt, it had nothing to do with his mandate to continue to January. That was a coup d'etat just right there. Now, the very fact that later we learned that this claim that there was malfeasance in the election was all false shows that the coup was deeper than that. And then the right wing comes to power backed by the United States and so on. Now, what struck me about that coup is that very quickly afterwards, lots of fair-minded, sensitive people in North America, in Europe, in other parts of the world said, well, you know, Evo Morales overstayed his welcome. Oh, well, there was fraud. Well, you know, they should do this, they should do that. In fact, denied the fact that there was a coup. The Guardian newspaper said there was no coup, and so on and so forth. You get the point. And the other thing is, who are you to say whether somebody had overstayed their welcome? After all, Angela Merkel in Germany has been in office longer than Evo Morales. Nobody has said, look, she should leave last year, year before last. No, you know, nobody says that. Here's the major native leader of a country, socialist leader of a country. Why should he be pushed out of office and then people turn around and say, well, let him go? So immediately after that, I said, my God, I need to write something to remind people of a long history of how this destabilization works. So I literally sat down, CS, over a few months and in a feverish pitch wrote this book. Right while I was writing the book, I was thinking about my old friend Eduardo Galeano. I'd gone to see him some years before he died in Montevideo. And I asked him then, you know, listen, you write these books about torture and so on. And they're so beautiful to read, you know, how do you do it? And Eduardo, you know, he was a very quick guy. He said, look, you know, torture is bad enough. Why should I torture the reader? You know, is there a way for me to elevate the reader so they grasp what torture is, but they are not tortured in the prose? I don't need to. I thought that was a kind of typical answer of his, you know, very clever and smart, but also filled with meaning. And I felt I want to write a book about the hideous history of US imperialism. I want it to be only about 120 pages. And at the same time, I want it to be filled with hope, saturated with hope and struggle and the contradictions. So I wrote this book with that in mind. The other thing about the book is, often people say, look, young people don't read. I don't think that's true. You know, people read, it's different forms of reading. So each section of the book is a little longer than a Facebook post in a way. And I don't have chapters that go on and on. I want people to sit down, start reading it, stop whenever they want, pick up whenever they can, and read it through. When I finished writing it, I was so happy that Evo Morales said, look, I'll write the preface to the book, the front piece to the book. And he wrote an incredible front piece because he wrote and said, look, the people will prevail. This was in early 2020. There was finally, after a year, there was an election in Bolivia. And Evo Morales' mask came back into power with a big majority. In fact, people who had been beaten on the streets, elected officials who had been beaten were re-elected, and the people put their trust on them and threw out the coup makers. It's a pretty incredible story, you know, CS. And I'm really happy that this book was, kind of in that story. Evo was thrilled with the book. And many times, on Twitter, he keeps saying, this is the fundamental book. And it just makes me want to burst into tears because the purpose of the book was to make the claim that this great man who for 14 years lifted up his people out of extreme poverty, this great man was being insulted, denigrated in such a way. And I thought, I want to write a book that demonstrates how hideous imperialism is and what it does to people who try to make a difference in the world.
Vijay Prashad, Indian historian and journalist. We've got a link on againstthegrain.org to Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, which he directs, to the dossier put out by Tricontinental entitled Dawn, Marxism and National Liberation, and to his recently published book, Washington Bullets, A History of the CIA, Coups and Assassination. Vijay, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you. And we go back so many years. I sometimes feel like I'm talking to you and it's the year 2000 or 1998 again.
It's been a long and fruitful collaboration, that is true. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.